Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, our position in this case is that the under color of official right portion of the Hobbs Act codifies, in effect, the old common law crime of official extortion, which was taken directly from New York law, which in turn had this crime of official extortion.
Mr. Bryson, if you're right on that, why is a maximum 20-year penalty attached to this particular offense, whereas both at common law and in New York law, as I understand, it was a misdemeanor with a very minor penalty?
Well, of course, at common law, Your Honor, a misdemeanor didn't mean that what it now means, which was that you would, in federal law, for example, be subject only to a one-year penalty, but it rather meant that it was not a crime that was subject to the death penalty, typically, and forfeiture of property. So a misdemeanor could result in imprisonment for life.
Well, could you be imprisoned for life under the common law rule?
Yes,
for the extortion?
Yes, you could, Your Honor.
And the Register of Deeds, who asked for $20 and got when he was only entitled to 10?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a misdemeanor, but again, misdemeanor applied to a very large number of cases, and the number of crimes that were subject to felony description was really rather small. It was still larger than those crimes that are subject to the death penalty today.
How about under New York law?
Under New York law, it was a misdemeanor, and that did not subject you to a long period of incarceration. But what I think the answer to the question is that what the Hobbs Act did was to take a whole range of offenses right out of New York law, including some very serious violent offenses, and say we're putting, as it was originally passed, a 10-year cap on this. And you can sentence from anything from 0 up to 10 years. And the crimes, of course, would range in seriousness from very serious violent crimes, perhaps resulting in death, to armed robberies, to very violent extortions, down to something that you might regard as being quite minimal, such as taking $10 to which you weren't entitled if you were a public official. And the sentencing court would, of course, have the freedom to sentence from anything from probation up to 10, and that is, it was later changed to 20 years. But we think it's so clear that Congress intended simply to take the entire New York's law of extortion, which included not only what we now can call official extortion, but also coercive extortion, two separate crimes, and put it into federal law, defining those two crimes separately. That is so clear that you have to look to New York law and the common law that undergirds New York law to determine what the scope of under color of official right is.
Mr. Bryson, do you know of any New York case? I looked in McCormick, and I could not find any. Could not find a single New York case that involved this crime of extortion, that is, under color of official right, that did not involve the classic case of asking for money that you were not entitled to by your office.
Your Honor, the only prosecution that we could find under the official extortion branch of the New York law was the old Whaley case.
The Whaley case. That's the only one I could find.
That's right. Now, that on its facts did involve, as you pointed out in your concurring opinion in McCormick, did involve a false pretenses type of
a claim of official right.
Well,
you don't think that's suspicious that the language says official right and the only case you can find under it, in fact, involved a claim of official right? Over how long a period? It was an old law. Went way back to...
It was an old case. Yeah. Hey, Your Honor,
in all those years, the only prosecution happens just accidentally to track the language of the statute.
Your Honor, the what's important, I think, about the Whaley case, which was the source for the field code, which in turn was the basis for the New York statutory code. The important thing about Whaley is not what it in fact involved. Yes, it involved, in fact, a false pretenses type of extortion. And there's no question that false pretenses type violation by an official was included within the common law notion of official extortion. But so was bribery, and so was, for that matter, coercive activity by the official. And the point of the Whaley case is found, I think, not so much in its facts as in what that court says the crime is. And what's really critical here, I think, is to look at the description of the crime, which is described in exactly the terms that Hawkins uses and cites Hawkins' Pleas of the Crown, which is the taking by color of office. It doesn't say taking by color of official right. What the field
bribery,
code
bribery
did,
was a separate offense under New York law, wasn't it? Bribery was not reached through this.
Bribery could certainly be reached through this. This was an alternate means of punishing bribery. It was called official extortion.
Never used.
It was not used. We don't know if it was never used, but all we know is that the cases did not come to the appellate courts. There were some instances, for example, of there was at least one instance of a police disciplinary action which was premised on that statute for taking money on the side, in which there was no indication that there was a false pretenses aspect of it. But that was not a prosecution as such. But what's important, I think, about the Whaley case, to repeat, is that it adopts in hic verba the common law formulation of official extortion, color of office. And what I think the field code and later the New York statutes themselves meant by official right is not right to the fee, but authority to perform official services. In other words, color of official right is not my claim of right to be paid, but my claim of right to take these kinds of activities. And the example I would give, Your Honor, is the policeman who, as in a case which is very parallel to the New York statute coming from Pennsylvania, in which the policeman said, give me $50 and I'll let you open this house of prostitution. Now, there's no question that there was no assertion of entitlement to the $50 by virtue of there being a $50 fee associated with opening houses of prostitution. Everyone that was a party to that transaction understood that the $50 was not a legitimate fee. But nonetheless, it was by virtue of his authority, his claim of right, his use of his office or misuse of his office, that was the basis for his obtaining the $50. And that is consistent with everything in the common law, all the way back to the first statute of Westminster in 1275, where there was no crime of bribery at all, the crime that was created was the crime of official extortion, and it covered a whole range of official misconduct, including classic bribery conduct, including conduct involving false representation, and including coercive conduct. And some examples, and I think the best source for these examples is the Law Review article, which we cite several times by Lindgren. But he goes through a number of these cases. The examples from the common law, one after another, are cases in which, for example, a jailer says to somebody who's being held, I will let you out if you give me some money. Everybody, there's no indication that there's some representation by the jailer that he is entitled to that fee. It's an obviously corrupt transaction. That's extortion under color of office. Now, our contention is that's exactly the crime that the New York law codified in 1881 when it passed what it amounts to the Field Code.
So you say, in effect, that under color of office means pretty much the same thing as under color of right?
Exactly. We say it means the same thing. And I think you can find the source for that in the New York law itself. Because if you take the New York statute that was enacted after the Field Code, this was the statute of 1881, and the provisions of this statute have continued right on through the period in which the Hobbs Act was enacted and right up until there was a large revamping of New York criminal law in 1965. But throughout the period that Congress was looking at both the Anti-Racketeering Act and the Hobbs Act.
Mr. Bryson, did your examples take you the furthest step to make it clear that at common law it would have been official extortion if the official had not made the first statement, give me the $50 and I'll let you out, but instead had been the recipient of a statement saying, here's $50, it's yours if you let me out. Would that have been comprehended at common law too?
We think absolutely, and I
Do you have examples like the examples you just gave to us?
I can't give you a case which says specifically that only in cases in which the official was not the initiator of the transaction, he is nonetheless guilty. But it's quite clear that no common law case turned on who was the initiator of the transaction. And in fact, the treatises that discuss the common law all talk in terms of obtaining property, not in terms of soliciting it or going out and seeking.
There's this argument to be made, isn't there, that at least in the non-official extortion by force, threat, and so on, the person who is going to end up with the money is making some kind of affirmative act to, in other words, he's making the threat or is applying the force, twisting the arm, or whatnot, And that at least would bear analogy with the official who initiates the transaction by saying, I will do thus and so if you give me the money. Whereas that analogy doesn't hold if he simply sits there and in response to the offer takes the money.
Well, actually, I think the analogy, first of all, I think that the way the common law courts looked at this problem was to say that someone's office itself has a very powerful potential coercive effect and that the officer doesn't have to underscore the matter by going out and soliciting. But I think the analogy further breaks down because there are coercive extortion cases in which the defendant is not the person who puts someone in fear. The defendant, let's say a mob boss, is not the person who either initiates the fear or takes any sort of steps to put the person in fear. He merely exploits the fear. He knows that that person fears that if he does not pay money to be allowed to run his business in the neighborhood, for example, that he will something will happen to him.
Yeah, but that's because he's broken somebody else's arm.
Well, not necessarily.
At some point, he's initiated something.
Well, that is typically true, of course, in official extortion, too. There's a reason that people come to officials thinking that they may benefit from dealing with this official. But setting that aside, it isn't necessary to show that he has threatened somebody in the past, merely that he knows that he is feared and that he takes money exploiting that fear. But in any event, it's quite clear that the common law did not distinguish between payments that were accepted without solicitation, as in classic bribery cases, and payments in which one went out and solicited a bribe.
So is there an instruction required that the payor must know that if he doesn't pay, there will be adverse action taken against him?
Well, it doesn't matter. You mean in the coercive extortion case, such as I... No, that's not necessary. All that's necessary is that the payee believe that the payor is paying either in order to induce the payor to take action in his favor or out of fear that adverse action will be taken. In the
But in this case, was the jury instructed that there had to be some anticipation or fear on the grounds of the payor that adverse action would be taken?
No, it was not, and that isn't necessary. We contend under official extortion. In other words, extortion.
Is that because we presume that fear is present whenever you're dealing with an official?
No, it is because in the common law and again in the New York law, there didn't have to be a sense of compulsion in the sense of fear in order to establish official extortion, even if you were seeking only benefit. In other words, even if you had no concern at all that you would be dealt with unfairly unless you made the payment, but were seeking only to get an unfair advantage over all your competitors, let's say in bidding, you would be guilty of, or the official who takes the money would be guilty of official extortion.
How do you know that under New York? As I say, the only case I know of involving this under New York law is that one case that you mentioned.
Well,
also know about New York law is that bribery was a separate crime and that if you proved that the payment was voluntary, you could not be convicted of extortion. That was the great divide between bribery and extortion. If it was a voluntary payment, it was bribery.
Your Honor, 2 points. First of all, with respect to the latter point, there is the cases to which you're pointing in New York law regarding this distinction between bribery and extortion related to coercive extortion. That is to say, those cases involved the leg breaker type extortion, and there, sensibly enough, the court said you can't be convicted of bribery if somebody has threatened to break your leg unless you pay.
But would it not make sense to put in with those cases official extortion in the very narrow sense of extortion by an official who says, you got to make the payment. I won't break your arm, but I'll put you in jail. It's a matter of right.
Well,
I have a right to this payment as a government official. It makes sense to put that in with the arm breaker.
Let me go to my second point, which is to read the provision of the 1881 New York Code, which, again, has come all the way through the period of the Hobbs Act to 1965 that relates to official extortion that goes beyond just the definitional section that found its way into the Hobbs Act. There were three different pertinent sections of New York law here. First, there was the definitional section, which is almost identical to the section that appears as the definition of extortion in the Hobbs Act. Then there was another section which described extortion by fear, that is to say coercive extortion. Then there was a third section that separately set out the offense of official extortion. And let me read it to you and see if this doesn't resolve what exactly it was that this offense was directed at, because I think it's quite clear.
Is this in your brief?
Yes.
Where?
This is, the statute is not set out, but it is described at page, at page 25 of our brief in the middle, and I think, that's where it appears. But let me read it, that section for you. It says that...
855?
25, I'm sorry. 25 of our brief.
Section 855.
Section 855, which was originally Section 557 of the 1881 Code. In 1909, it was changed to 855. Extortion by public officers, a public officer who asks or receives or agrees to receive a fee or other compensation for his official service commits extortion. That includes someone not only who asks, but also who receives. Those are alternate grounds for liability.
Could you read that once more?
Certainly. A public officer who asks or receives or agrees to receive a fee or other compensation for his official service. There is no suggestion here that there is a claim of right to that money. This is simply I'm taking it for official services, and official services as understood throughout the common law was.
So I take it if some constituent just sends in $10,000 to a congressman or a senator saying, I know you're performing great services for the country, and I want to supplement your compensation. And the fellow takes it.
I think that would not be, Your Honor, because that would not be a payment. The common law is very clear. The payment had to be related to a specific service. If, however, the constituent sent the money in and said, I want to pay you for having or for voting on Bill X, or even for having voted on Bill X.
I know you're a great supporter of the farmer, and I'm a farmer.
Well, the closer you get to saying, please vote for the farm bill, here's $10,000, setting aside the campaign contribution complexity. But
from the language you read, it sounds as if the Register of Deeds, who asked for $10 to record a deed and the fee is $10, is guilty of extortion.
Well, no, Your Honor. I think this, when they refer to fee or
I'm sorry.
The rest of the statute goes on for a while. Says in excess of the amount permitted or where it's not permitted.
Thank you.
That is part of. Well, I think it's not pertinent to our inquiry here because there's no question that we're not talking about.
Why isn't it pertinent, Mr. Bryson? Our statute is quite different here. It refers only to obtaining property from another with his consent under color of official right.
That doesn't have
a limiting factor. It doesn't say in excess of. So why isn't the $10 fee extortion?
Well, because our statute picks up on the New York definition, and in order to determine what New York law is, we would have to go down to this.
I'm not talking about that. If we refer to the Hobbs Act.
Yes.
The term extortion means the obtaining of property from another with his consent under color of official right.
Right. That's right. Now, the way we suggest that this has to be read is that it has to be read as incorporating New York law. We have to determine what does obtaining property under color of official right, and what it means is, with respect to official extortion, you have to look to Section 557 of the New York law, which talked in terms, as the common law had, of taking compensation which is beyond that which is permitted to you. There's no question that you can take cash your check each week without violating the Hobbs Act, and that New York law makes clear, as does federal law. There's no question that.
Well, I understand that, but the statute doesn't say that.
Well, the statute uses a term of art, and our position is that term of art is not, it has to be read in light of its origins, which were in New York law and the common law. And its origins make quite clear that we are talking about compensation in excess of that which you are permitted.
But you will admit that on its face it has no limiting principle.
Well, I think, yes, I think that the words under color of official right on their face do not, answer the question of how broad the statute is. That's true of many common law terms that show up in criminal statutes. So you could have the word mayhem in and of itself does not strike one as having a particular meaning, but you look to the common law for the meaning of a term like that when it shows up in the statute.
Mr. Bryson, the step in the argument that I guess I'm unclear on is, taking the definition as you just read it from the New York statute, how does that become subsumed under the term of art that is being used in the Hobbs Act? I mean, the New York statute didn't use the same term that the Hobbs Act used.
No. The New York statute uses the term in its definitional section of extortion under color of official right. That is clear that points to official...
Okay, but it did use that term.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The language from the definitional section was taken word for word and put right into the 1934 Act, which was the predecessor of the Hobbs Act, and the Hobbs Act changed about two words that aren't pertinent here.
Bryson, I'd like to ask you two questions. One, I think you may have misspoken. I want to be sure I misunderstood you. I think you said that if a constituent sends in a check for $10,000 and says, I'm giving you this money because last year you voted for Bill X, may he keep that check?
He may not.
Even if it's for past services?
For past services.
I mean, prior communication between them at all and no quid pro quo there.
Well, that would involve the gratuity as opposed to the taking of a bribe. But we think that the Hobbs Act does extend to certain kinds of gratuities when the performance and the payment are linked as closely as they would be in your hypothetical. And let me give you a case that exemplifies why that is so. The CUDA case from the Seventh Circuit involved a case in which a builder in Chicago sought a zoning permission to have a zoning variance from an alderman. The alderman gave his permission, and then the builder went back later and said, how much do I owe you? And the alderman said $1,500. Now, there was no prior understanding, arrangement, or whatnot, but that was deemed to be extortion under color of official right because it was a compensation for a specific official act. That, we think, would apply.
Yes, but the evidence there would suggest that the parties understood that compensation would be paid sooner or later. I'm not sure that's exactly like my hypothetical.
Well, it is our position.
But in any event, that's not raised by this case.
That's right. That isn't this case, but it would be our position that at least with respect to a specific payment for a specific act, it would include certain kinds of gratuities.
Now, may I ask one other question, just a matter of information? If we disagreed with your reading of the extortion statute, what is there a provision of the criminal code that covers the knowing acceptance of money that the donor expects to be used to pay for a legislative vote or something?
I would think you would have to go to the Travel Act, which is the statute that governs interstate travel or transportation or the use of interstate facilities to effect a violation of state bribery or extortion laws. Then you would have to prove, of course, there was some...
There's no independent, just plain garden variety like a bribe. There's no separate crime other than extortion, a federal crime, for the receipt of a bribe.
Well, except with respect to federal officials, of course. Federal officials would be covered, but with respect to state officials and local officials...
Oh, I see.
They would not be covered. I'm sorry, Section 201 covers federal officials. The Travel Act would cover, depending on what the particular state law was, would cover bribery and extortion.
And also the donor is not picked up under this statute either. I mean, you just get the person who receives it for the extortion, unlike the bribery statutes, which...
That's right, although there's a question. The question would be open as to whether you could prosecute the donor under certain circumstances for aiding and abetting, but that is a separate question in which there has been some case law, but it has not been resolved.
Were donors ever or payors ever prosecuted under the New York statute?
There haven't been, some, to my knowledge, very many prosecutions under that statute. I am not aware of donors ever being prosecuted for extortion under either the New York statute or even any of the other state statutes where prosecutions were more common, as in New Jersey or Pennsylvania, where the prosecutions were more common. You found in those cases, as I mentioned before, standard bribery-type conduct, but you always found only the recipient, the official, being prosecuted. And that is consistent with the traditional common law approach, which is to say this is a crime committed by the official, and certainly a violation against public justice rather than any form of property crime or any form of crime as to which the payor would be separately liable. I think, if I may very briefly address the question of the language of the statute, not the official right, but the inducement feature. If you look at the 1934 Act, it becomes even clearer, I think, than it is in the 1946 Act, that the induced clause applies to the coercive instruction portion of the statute and not to the under color of official right. The 1934 statute says whoever obtains with his consent property, comma, induced by fear or force, comma, or under color of official right. In other words, it makes there's less language in the coercive induced section, and therefore it's clearer that the induced relates to force or fear and not to color of official right. And that is consistent with the common law concept of obtaining property under color of official right. You never find in the treatises of the time, in the cases, you never find the language induced under color of official right. You find obtains or takes by color of office or under color of office, or again in
the. But is it not true that most of the courts of appeals that have addressed this have assumed that it was inducement to accept the money in exchange for the commitment?
That's correct. They have assumed that, and I think the assumption was incorrect, because I think they found it unnecessary to nothing turned on it, because they said, well, the office does the inducing, therefore no additional inducement is required. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryson. Mr. Abbott, your time had expired, so the case is submitted.